It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a guest tells us that some popular evolutionary arguments about what men want from women and vice versa are probably wrong. First, during yesterday's annual State of the State address, Governor Walker unveiled his new child tax credit plan. The $122 million plan would give Wisconsin parents a $100 credit per child. And Governor Walker said that it could have a big impact on families around the state.
It could be a new pair of shoes, a winter coat, activity fees at school, or maybe a copay at the doctor or the dentist office. We know sometimes Wisconsin families face challenges when making ends meet. And this new child tax credit, well, we think it can help. Today, I'm joined by families from all over Wisconsin who will benefit from our child tax credit.
Laurel White is with us now for more. She's the state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Laurel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
We'll talk about the details of what we know, at least about how this credit would work.
So we just got news about this credit shortly before the speech yesterday. So we don't have a ton of details yet, but we do know that it's $100 per child annually for parents, and that the $122 million a year cost would be covered in the first year by a budget surplus that was recently announced for the state.
And what would the rollout time be for this? This would be 2018?
That's right. So the governor said he was hoping that individuals would have the money in their pockets for the next school year, before the next school year, so they would be able to do things like buy those winter coats and those shoes that he mentioned. And as he's been traveling the state today talking about this new tax credit, he's been talking about parents buying backpacks as well for school.
And this is something that the state legislature would have to turn around fairly quickly, right?
That's right. And I was able to ask GOP leadership yesterday, right after the State of the State, what they thought about this proposal. That's kind of one of the perks that reporters have after the State of the State. We get to go right out onto the floor and get immediate reaction. And Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald said that he personally thought it was a good idea and that it had been warmly received by Republican senators that morning when they first heard about it in caucus. And Assembly Speaker Robin Voss said he agreed with it. I believe his words were generally. And so he was looking forward to getting some more details. But it sounds like the leadership is pretty much on board with this moving forward at this point.
And what did we hear from Democrats about this?
Well, Democrats were a little bit more of a mixed bag. Of course, as you know, there were three different Democratic gubernatorial candidates in the office, in the audience, rather, for the State of the State yesterday. So I was anxious to go up and talk with them and see what they thought about this child tax credit. Representative Dana Walks, who is a Democratic assemblyman from Eau Claire, he said that this was a step in the right direction, but not quite enough. I think his exact words were that the governor is kind of nibbling around important issues. So I think he would say that there's more that can be done here. I also talked with State School Superintendent Tony Evers, who's also running as a Democrat for governor. And he said that this was just too little too late for the people of Wisconsin, that he could think of better ways to help parents in Wisconsin than a $100 check. He didn't get specific about what those things were when I was talking to him yesterday, but it sounds like he's not incredibly enthusiastic about the plan.
And this is an election year, of course, and anything, I guess, in a State of the State address is going to be viewed through the lens of a governor looking for re-election and then his opponents in the other party looking to win their primary and then run against him.
That's right. I mean, this was a really unique State of the State in that it is an election year. The governor has formally announced that he's running for a third term as governor, and things are really ramping up. I mean, I know I've spoken with you about the 10th Senate district in Wisconsin that flipped from a Republican to a Democrat recently. That was a district that a lot of people, if you'd spoken to them a year ago or a couple years ago, would be incredibly shocked to hear that a Democrat was elected. That was considered a pretty safe Republican district. It's one that the president won by, I think, 17 points in 2016. So, you know, there's a lot of political talk in the Capitol right now, a lot of political vibes floating around. So, of course, the State of the State was put through a pretty political lens yesterday.
Laurel White is with us, state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News, looking at the state of the state address yesterday, starting with the child tax credit that the governor unveiled there and some of the other items on the list. Anything else that was a day of surprise that struck you, Laurel, in that address?
You know, Rob, that was really the only big surprise on the day of. The rest of the speech were things that the governor has been talking about for a while. I'm not sure if this is typical for a state of the state, but this year, I know for sure we were kind of getting a drip, drip, drip of news in the days leading up to the state of the state. So, for example, we heard in the week prior that the governor was calling a special session on welfare bills. So he had proposed, the sponsors are technically Representative Robin Voss in the Assembly and Senator Chris Kapinga in the Senate, but the governor is backing about 10 bills that look at welfare in the state and making some changes to things like drug testing and ID requirements. So we knew that was happening. We knew he had announced that, but he took a sizable chunk, I would say, of his state of the state to focus on that.
The governor, as you say, laid out a lot there, and it's a lot of new stuff, including this tax credit we started off with, the Medicaid stabilization, the mm-hmm. healthcare stability plan, welfare reform. You mentioned the special session. A lot going on. How much more session time does the legislature have to get all this done?
Not a lot. Not a lot. So there are differing views in the Capitol about how much longer legislators are actually going to stick around this year. They technically have until the second week of May for this legislative session. I've heard some rumors floating around that they're going to wrap up in March. Who knows? We can't speculate. But maximum, they've only got about, a little over 3 months left. So that's an awful lot to get done. Healthcare changes, welfare changes, school funding changes, a major change to the juvenile justice system in the state of Wisconsin. That's another thing that the governor talked about in his state of the state. So it's not like lawmakers in Wisconsin aren't used to doing things quickly sometimes when they need to, but they definitely have a full plate in terms of what the governor laid out for them yesterday.
Right, and process on these kinds of things, if we can bore people with process a little, it's not, here's the idea, we vote on it tomorrow, boom. There are usually, it goes through committees and hearings and things like that.
Right. I mean, in some cases, some of these proposals have already been heard in committee. For example, I was in a public hearing, which is the first committee step this morning for one of the education proposals that the governor supported in his state of the state yesterday. So some of them have already been heard in committee. Others haven't yet. So you're right. They're at different stages of the process, and the process can be lengthy sometimes. And there are different requirements for time to get them through that process. So it'll be interesting to see kind of what comes up first. Things that hit some more snags maybe need to be negotiated a little bit more within the Republican majority, maybe later, getting pushed toward that March or maybe April or May timeframe.
And Laurel, a lot of these items involve dollar signs that are about the state getting or spending money. Are these things usually handled within the state budget, a lot of the things that the governor was talking about?
Well, that's interesting that you should mention that, Rob, because some of these things were included in the state budget, but were taken out for one reason or another. The school proposal that the governor really pushed in his state of the state yesterday has to do with rural districts in the state that get something called sparsity aid, and that has to do with the number of people that live per square mile, and then also low spending districts that don't spend a certain amount per pupil. And what they want to do there is kind of raise a cap so some schools can spend more money. And that's something that was included in the state budget and something that particularly Assembly Republicans were really excited about. But the governor vetoed it from the budget because he was concerned about voter accountability and raising taxes without a referendum. So, yes, some of these things have been seen before and were part of the budget, but they were gone.
We'll have to leave it there. Laurel, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Rob.
Laurel White, state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News, looking at some of the highlights of Governor Walker's State of the State address. History and literature have given us a lot of stories about heterosexual men seeking youth and beauty and women seeking stability in wealth when it comes to partners. It was a big theme in Pride and Prejudice, for example, Jane Austen's 18th century book, which was adapted into movies several times. Here's a clip from the 2005 Hollywood version.
Mr. Collins and I are engaged.
Engaged?
Yes.
To be married?
Yes, of course, Lizzie. What other kind of engaged is there? Oh, for heaven's sake, Lizzie, don't look at me like that. There is no earthly reason why I shouldn't be as happy with him as any other.
But he's ridiculous.
Oh, hush. Not all of us can afford to be romantic. I've been offered a comfortable home and protection. There's a lot to be thankful for.
Charlotte.
I'm 27 years old. I've no money and no prospects. I'm already a burden to my parents. And I'm frightened.
Many evolutionary psychologists have argued that we have these preferences because of our early human history. The theory goes something like this. Our male ancestors were concerned with reproduction, so they looked for younger females who offered fertility. And our female ancestors would have to carry and care for their young, so they looked for males who would be providers. But our next guest says there's enough data out there to prove otherwise. Marcel Zentner is a professor of psychology at the University of Innsbruck, where he heads the Personality, Emotion, and Music Lab. Marcel, welcome to Central Time.
It's a pleasure.
Well, you say maybe we put too much faith in this evolutionary argument about what men are looking for in women and what women are looking for in men. Why do you say that?
Well, I think that the scientific basis for a lot of these assumptions is fairly thin because I mean, it's all about basically hypotheticals, right? It's about some ideas about what might have been the case in the past. It's about biological hypothesis that because, you know, men can have many children and women less so, then, you know, that influences their preferences. But it's, again, it's all hypotheticals.
Do we start with whatever the conditions might be or what we think they are in the present day and just kind of work back and say, aha, it must have been evolution?
Yes, yes, exactly. So there is this biological theory, you know, that, that there are these very different sort of biological kind of conditions in the sense that women can have less children than men. And from there, exactly, you know, all these assumptions come out that for men, beauty and attractiveness are more important. For women, it's more sort of the resources. And then indeed, so that's already basically, you know, just an assumption or a theory, if you want. And then indeed, a lot of evolution psychologists are running experiments now that then try to somehow substantiate these hypotheticals. So it rests on relatively shaky ground, I'd say.
And a big part of your research on this topic has been looking at different societies around the world and seeing how the desirability of men or women might change as gender imbalances change. How do you try to measure that?
So exactly, and I think that's a very important point to mention. So in contrast to the evolutionary sort of model that is very strongly based on hypotheticals, we actually measure mate preferences and can relate them to other current factor that we can measure. And that gives our explanations, I think, a stronger empirical foundation. And one of the factors that we have been measuring is gender equality that varies a lot from society to society. And we were able to show that the smaller the gender gap, the smaller these sex differences in mate preferences between men and women become.
Can you talk a little bit about the different societies you studied and the range, the variation you found from one place to another?
Yeah, so what we really focused on was the degree of gender inequality, and the United Nations and as well the World Economic Forum, they come up with a ranking every year that basically places nations on a scale from, you know, relatively good in gender equality to quite poor. And we have really taken into account not all the nations, but a lot of nations. And so there is a lot of variation in terms of gender equality that we have been looking at. And in all these countries, we looked also at women's and men's mate preferences. And that's how we actually came up with this interesting correlation.
Yeah, talk through that correlation a little more. As gender inequality goes down, so as men and women are more equal than not, what changes in terms of what men are looking for in terms of what women are looking for?
Yeah, so in general, you can say the differences in their mate preferences get smaller. And that, I mean, to become a little bit more specific, for example, men place somewhat less importance on youth and beauty. And women, and that's the changes are actually mostly evident in women, and women look for... well, I should also say that men actually place now more importance on such things as education, women's education and their earning prospects. And women, on the other hand, are less interested in men's earning prospects and educational levels.
And so what does that tell us about this as an evolutionary cause of those differences if these things can change over the course of really not that big a span of time?
Well, I think it's an unnecessary assumption. I mean, you can make the assumption that there is some biological basis in the sense of evolutionary biological basis to it, but I don't think it's necessary. I just don't see the need because you can explain it so neatly by looking at this social and also socio-demographic factors.
Talking to Marcel Zettner from the University of Innsbruck, looking at what men are looking for in women, what women look for in men, and whether there are evolutionary causes for differences or whether they're more socially based. And Marcel, you addressed briefly in a piece you wrote, same-sex couples, it sounds like there's really not enough data to start to make these broader comparisons. Is that right?
No, I think it would be very important and very interesting to have these studies, but we were not able to find enough studies that would allow us to make any conclusions.
Getting back to the basic stereotype that people have said, yeah, this is grounded in evolution, the idea that a woman is going to seek a powerful man, a wealthier man, one who can provide, a man's going to seek a younger, more attractive woman. This does seem to hold true in the more unequal societies. Are you looking at maybe the conditions of that inequality as leading to that those differences between men and women?
Absolutely. So you have to just consider. So if you have, you're very dependent on a man, then obviously. Economically dependent, I mean, you're going to look for someone who has a relatively high status or has higher earnings and so on. That's an entirely rational calculation that a woman makes that, in my view, it is not really necessary to presume that this has anything to do with a biological urge. And actually, it would also go the other way around. So we see now that men are actually placing more importance on women's education. Why is that? That is because men are more likely to lose their job at the moment. And we also find that there are more educated women than men. So all these social demographic shifts can quite plausibly explain why the mate preferences are shifting.
As we talk about early human societies and evolution, it seems like you could come up with a hypothetical picture that looks more like a gender equal society if it's a society where hunting and gathering divided, women do the gathering, men do the hunting. You could see both sides putting a premium on the economic success and skill of the other partner, men and women. We could come up with assumptions that that go either way if we wanted to.
That's correct. And I think, I'm not a historian, but I think if you look at evolution and at earlier times in history, you found both. So there were times where women actually were quite instrumental in securing the economic resources for survival. And then there were other periods where they had a more peripheral roles. It has changed in the past. It's not that there is like this one past mm-hmm. that evolutionary psychologists often kind of relate to. The societies and the division of labor between women have also changed in very ancient times.
It seems like as we go back to human evolution, it seems like it must have done something to our psychology and some of our built-in preferences. How do we start to sort out what of our behavior is evolutionarily determined and what isn't? What is economically determined today or socially determined?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, there are biological factors, right? So, and I think one factor that is important, but it's important not because, you know, we have to make assumptions about the past. It's happening right now. So it's women who are, actually are having children and are usually caring for the children more so than men. And that, of course, does put them at a economic disadvantage. In a certain sense, unless, you know, this loss of time when or loss of time, it's maybe not the right word, but just the time they need to invest to care for their babies, they have to compensate for that somehow. And that could explain why they're still, to a certain extent, looking for men with earning with sort of good earning potentials. Why I'm saying that is that you can see how the link between biology and choices and preferences works and can work. And I think there clearly is a biological factor in there. But yes, I personally don't really see the need to kind of make any assumptions about our evolutionary past in explaining current behaviors.
And you started a recent piece talking about a hypothetical future of how men and women evaluate each other. Can you talk about what the future might hold for us?
Well, the future is already here. So what we see now is that more, as I said, more women are educated or more educated in general worldwide at the moment than men. Men have problems, economical problems, in the sense that they're starting to lose their jobs. And these are very important shifts that need to be factored in. Our society is not only changing in the future, it has changed, it is changing right now. And that puts men and women into entirely different roles. So I think that now, of course, and you might say, well, but why don't we see sort of the gender equal kind of dating scenario that I've described in my piece? It will obviously take time. These things do not change overnight.
Marcel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
That was Marcel Zentner, psychology professor at the University of Innsbruck. We all face difficult times in our lives. Maybe it's the prospect of a divorce, news about a diagnosis, deciding to come clean about a dishonest act, moving older parents to a nursing home, you name it. While a choice of who to confide in might seem obvious, a spouse, a close friend, or a family member, our guest has learned that we often choose acquaintances or even strangers or near strangers instead. Mario Luis Small is a sociologist and Grafstein Family Professor of Sociology at Harvard University. He joins us now to talk about his recent book. It's called Someone to Talk To. Mario, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here, Rob.
Well, you, in your book, you say when you're trying to explain what you're working on to people, you'd ask them a few questions that might be used in a sociological survey. Can you tell us about those questions to get us started thinking about who we talk to?
Yeah, it's a pretty standard set of questions. So imagine if I ask you in a survey, you know, from time to time there are people we need to talk to when we have to something important and personal to confide in someone. Who are the people in your life who you turn to? And what you find, if you're like me, is that most people will say something like, well, if in my case, for example, it's my wife, it's probably my closest colleague at work, and maybe one of my closest friends from childhood who I've been in touch with for 30 years or so. But then what's interesting is that if you ask him a very different set of questions, you might get a very different answer. Suppose that instead of doing that, if I said, look, think about everything you're experiencing right now, and think about the two, maybe three most personally important, perhaps difficult things that you're going through right now, whatever they are. And Rob, I won't ask you to tell me, but just try to think about them. It could be something with your health, perhaps something with your relationships, maybe your finances, maybe some crisis that was unexpected. Just think about them. Now that you have them in mind, I'm going to ask you a very different question. Now think about the very last time you talked to anybody about that first thing you thought about, or the last time you talked to anyone about that second thing. Now, what's interesting is that when I think about this question, almost always, at least one or the two last people I actually talked to turn out to be people very different from who I would normally say are the people I usually confide in. And more importantly, those other people, the people I've often talked to, are sometimes people I'm actually not that close to. People who, in theory, aren't even the kind of people I would call my confidants. And that is the issue I started exploring.
And you write that this isn't just you, based on surveys and then based on your work for this book, following a group of graduate students in different departments. This is super common. We think of the people who are close to us as the people we'd talk to. Again, maybe that spouse, sibling, whatever. But when push comes to shove, the people we talk to are not always, not usually even those close people. How common is it for us to reach outside that close network to talk about the serious stuff?
Very, very common. So it turns out that if you ask people, there are lots of different ways of asking this question, but if you ask them just, hey, who do you think you talk to, or who are you regularly close to, they're going to name on average, at least Americans will name on average, somewhere between 3 and 4.5, 5 people, depending on how you frame the question. Now, I found using a data representative of the U.S. population, we asked a nationally representative population this question, and we asked them who they'd actually talked to the last time they talked to anyone. And we found that just about half the time, actually technically speaking, slightly more than half the time, the people they'd last talked to about the issues they told us were the most important issues in their life that concerned them were not actually people they were close to.
So who are we talking to that if it's not that close, what we might think of as our close support network? Who do we find and why do we pick them?
Now, that's part of what's interesting about this. So first, we'll talk to, you know, pretty much anyone. Part of what's interesting is that if your listeners are like me, we tend to think of ourselves as pretty rational people who are not going to just go around and share our personal secrets or our personal difficulties with just any random person. But the truth is, if you look at the distribution of people that our respondents were willing to talk to, we're talking everything from bartenders, the person at the barbershop, the beautician at the nail salon, the person you're working out with at the gym, person in yoga class, a random colleague, a person who, you know, you run into on the elevator or a bus stop, or the person sitting next to you on the airplane. People actually will talk to a wide swath of people about their issues. Now, once you dig a little deeper, it gets a little more complicated because it turns out that people aren't just making decisions without thinking about them, although sometimes they actually are. But in truth, what ends up happening is people tend to turn to different people for different reasons. A lot of the time what happens is you're expressly trying to avoid the people you're close to, precisely because they're too close for comfort. Mm-hmm. You know, some people think about, you know, the people who, well, they found a lump in their body and they don't want to worry their spouse until they know for sure. So it takes them a while. It takes them a while to go to the doctor and start talking about this. And it's only when they're really sure that they're going to talk to their spouse. Or maybe the problem they're having involves their spouse or involves someone they're close to. Maybe they've done something shameful, right? The person who, I don't know, is going through financial difficulties and, I don't know, cheated on their taxes. They're not going to want to tell their close friends often because they don't want those people to have a negative impression of them. So a lot of the times, even though it sounds strange at the beginning, what ends up happening is people are just avoiding the people they're close to.
Mario Luis Small is with us. He's a sociologist, author of the book Someone to Talk To. He's writing about who we confide in and why it's often not the people closest to us in our lives. You write about in the group of grad students you studied, one from a working class background at an expensive school, feeling like he was, you know, one problem away from kind of losing everything he'd built up toward. One person he didn't want to talk to was his mom for a variety of reasons. Can you tell us some of why he didn't reach out to that person who was close to him?
Absolutely. And this is part of what's interesting. I mean, I studied a population of graduate students. So even though they're, you know, pursuing higher degrees, they face as many problems as everyone else does. This was somebody who didn't have a lot of money. He was married. He had a child. And he had health insurance through his university. His wife, who was under 26, had health insurance through her own mother. But their child had no insurance. And so they were trying to get on Medicaid, et cetera. And he commuted to the office. And his big worry, though, was one day, you know, he'd say, you know, gosh, if my truck breaks down and it's $1,000, we're done. I mean, I just have no savings, no nothing. Now, what's interesting is that this is something that, of course, worried him. And in addition to needing money, sometimes he just needed to talk about it. And what was powerful about his case is that even though just before we did our interview, he had told me that his mother was one of the closest people in his life and he was willing to talk to her about just about anything, he absolutely refused to talk to her about this issue. And the reason is simple. She was broke too. She didn't have a lot of money. She wasn't actually broke. She was poor. And so were his grandparents. And so he feared that the minute he brought it up, even if he was just trying to vent, you know, sometimes you just need to vent. Oh my goodness, you know, the truck broke down or I don't know how I'm going to make it, that the mother would feel guilty and send him money that she didn't have, get into debt for his sake and so on. So it was a sense, in a sense, what he was trying to do was protect his own confidant, his own mother, from his own problems.
We had a caller who couldn't stay on the line who wanted to point out that programs like AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, or other anonymous support groups are based on principles of anonymity so people can share really the worst moments of their lives freely with people who, in many cases, don't know them at all. And it's easier maybe than talking to someone you're close to.
Absolutely. And actually, I think to the extent that programs such as AA and NA work, a lot of the reason they work is the opportunity for people to just vent, to talk in a context, not just without judgment, and not just where your family, who you may be embarrassed or ashamed or have a hard time talking to, are going to be there, but also where people are going to understand. You know, Rob, that's one of the most important things we found, that often when people were going out and seeking people they were not close to, people who were basically sometimes even strangers, the major thing they were looking for was cognitive empathy, the sense that this person is going to understand my experience as I experience it. And that is one of the most powerful things that people often in places like AA report themselves finding.
Mario Luis Small is with us, professor of sociology at Harvard University. His new book is called Someone to Talk To. We're talking about who we choose to confide in when we deal with tough situations, why we choose them, and why it's often not the people who are closest to us. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Who do you think of as the person you'd go to talk to about a tough situation? And, phrasing it differently, who have you actually talked to about a tough situation lately? Is it somebody who's close to you or maybe somebody with a little more distance, an acquaintance, a professional relationship, the person at the hair salon, say? Did somebody confide in you, somebody that you wouldn't have expected to? What helps you? Who does it help you to talk to? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. We continue our conversation with Mario Luis Small, professor of sociology at Harvard University. We're talking about his most recent book, Someone to Talk To, looking at our social networks and who we go to when we've got something serious to talk about. Well, we want to talk to you. Who do you go to when you've got a serious issue in your life that you need to vent about, bounce it off of somebody else? Call in now at 800-642-1234. Problem with a job or a relationship? Who do you like to talk to? And is it that person you're close to on a day-to-day basis, or is it somebody with a little more distance? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Mario, let's talk a little bit about what we can do with this, because it seems like this would have some practical application, this way of thinking about things, if we're trying to figure out ways to make it possible for, say, someone to report sexual harassment at work or bullying at school. Are there lessons we can draw here to find the right person for them to talk to?
Absolutely. So I would say sort of probably the most important lesson has to do with forgetting the assumption that people need to be really close to the person who needs to talk in order for them to be good confidants. The truth is, most of us, even if we don't see ourselves as very good listeners or very good speakers or whatever it is, can and have probably more often than we typically realize serve as confidants for others. One of the most powerful things I learned when studying this book was I was looking at the experiences of teachers who worked in public school districts where the fact that they were gay or lesbian was problematic, and so they had to keep it to themselves because it might have an impact on how they were evaluated professionally. Now, one of the very interesting things I learned in that context is when many of these teachers eventually ended up coming out, they did so to people who just happened to be present and willing to listen at the time they needed to do it. In other words, the predicament, this was in the 1990s. This was some narratives of people who were at a time in a context where there was less openness about sexuality than there is now, even though, as we all know, there's still we still have a ways to go. And one of the most powerful things I learned from their experiences was that really the presence of somebody willing to talk is more important than the fact that that person has an especially close relationship to you. I would say a second quick lesson that's powerful is the importance of empathy over sympathy. Now, we often think about sympathy as being important, being sympathetic. But the truth is, a lot of what I found is that most of the people who were looking for an ear weren't actually looking for sympathy so much as empathy. So sympathy is sort of the sense of sorrow or pity, kind of what you feel for the suffering of another person. When you're seeing the hungry child on the television, and you see the plea for help, but what the thing that's prompting you to write the check is sympathy. It's not really empathy. Because empathy, at least cognitive empathy, is the ability to experience what someone else is experiencing. Unless you've experienced prolonged hunger, you actually don't cognitively understand what that person is experiencing. What you're feeling is really sympathy. But it turns out empathy, the ability to get what someone else is going through, it turns out to be really, really important when people are looking for someone to talk to.
I want to bring in a caller who might fit into that point. Tom is with us in Neenah. Tom, hi.
Hi. Great show. I just want to say, as a guy whose wife has Alzheimer's dementia, I found myself unable to talk about things in certain ways with our kids, some of whom are in denial and some of whom they're all over the spectrum. So we formed a support group, started with just two of us, of men who have wives with Alzheimer's, and we talk about things in an entirely different way. And to your point, aren't looking for sympathy. We're all in a bad boat. We're looking for empathy, but also kind of practical advice and a feeling of I've been where you are or, you know, and got through it or that kind of feeling. So I was never much of a believer in support groups. And this changed my feeling about it, and I never thought about it in terms that your guest has put it until I heard this show. So thank you for that.
Tom, thank you. Yeah, thank you so much for calling in, Tom. I'm glad you found someone to talk with about that. And there is exactly what you were just saying, I think, Mario. He's not looking for sympathy. He's looking for somebody who's experienced the same things, bounced stories off each other and ideas. And I've heard we've talked to veterans on the show in the past who said, yeah, the best people to talk about my veteran stuff with is other veterans. Yeah. So that's a great example that Tom gave us.
Absolutely. It's absolutely right. And it's actually pretty much spot on. What's interesting about this and what Tom, I think, illustrated for us is we don't really often want to think of ourselves as people who need sympathy or help or pity. And part of the reason he hadn't done it before is perhaps it sounds like sort of that issue. But the need to hear someone else understands what you're going through is actually quite powerful and cathartic. And I'm actually glad to hear that he was able to find a way to find a support group where he could just talk and talk openly and frankly in a way and in a way that others would understand and in a way that even his own children perhaps were having some difficulty with.
Tom, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to David with us in Milwaukee. David, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I have a couple, like two men friends I can talk to about when I got something going on. And one of the things I find is being a friend is being a good listener, be slow to speak and quick to listen, you know, and just hear the person out. Let them say, you know, don't be quick to respond. You know, I find it very helpful for when a friend's telling you, kind of laying their soul out. And I find that it's really helpful for me and for them, you know, to just listen. Sometimes I can remember as a teenager just wanting someone to talk to, and I couldn't find anyone to talk to. It was just worst possible thing in the world, thinking there was no one you could talk to about what you had going on, and I've always made myself available for people to do that, but like I said, be slow to speak and quick to listen, you know, and a lot of times people just want to be heard.
Gotcha. David, thank you so much for sharing that. Yeah, is that what people often are looking for, Mario, just to be heard, not necessarily, a solution?
Absolutely. And in fact, I love that phrase, slow to speak and quick to listen. I think a lot of the time, in a lot of the cases that we saw, that's precisely what people were looking for. And, the opportunity for that listener to be somebody who will just get you. Literally, they will just get what you're talking about. They don't have to give you advice, necessarily. They don't have to really often do much more than get what you're talking about. That benefit was surprisingly powerful for many of the people we spoke to.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Mario Luis Small, author of Someone to Talk To. We'll go next to Kathy on the line in Madison. Kathy, hi.
Well, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, what'd you want to tell us about, Kathy?
Well, I dated a fellow in a 12-step program who has been sober for a long, long time and initially had a job as a cab driver. And he told me that he did his 10th step, which is a confessional step, with his captive audiences in the form of his cab patrons.
Wow.
And he's been, so he goes to meetings regularly and talks about his, whatever's going on with him as well. It's not like he just did it and is done with. Mm-hmm. But initially he was working through those steps, and I don't know how his cab driver, how cab patrons felt about it, but he worked through those steps as appropriate, and he's been sober ever since. So.
Kathy, well, congratulations to him, and thanks for sharing that story. So I assume some people have done the opposite and given their story to the cab driver. Here's a cab driver taking the 10th step with his fares.
That's terrific.
Did you talk to people on the receiving end? Are people, like, if we want to talk to that acquaintance, somebody outside of our network, our immediate network a little bit, are people cool with that generally?
So what's interesting is the answer is yes. So what I love about the cab driver example is the cab drivers are actually often in the opposite role in a way that many people in jobs where they're captive listeners end up being. So a cab driver is a lot like a bartender, and it's a lot like a barber, and it's a lot like the person, like the beautician, in that these are a lot like a trainer at a gym. These are people who have a job. Technically speaking, their job is not to formally listen to you, but who have a job in which the context is intimate and the opportunity to talk is there, and often end up being the confidence for a whole bunch of people.
Mario, briefly, as we wrap up, in all this research, if after the show today someone comes up to me or whoever's listening and has that story, what advice do you have as the listener, that confidant of almost random choice, if that happens?
The most important thing I would say is you don't actually have to solve anyone's problems. Listening is half the battle.
It's a good place to leave it. Mario, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Rob. It's been a pleasure.
That's Mario Luis Small. He's a sociologist and Grafstein family professor of sociology at Harvard University. He joined us to talk about his most recent book, Someone to Talk To. He studies confidants, who we go to talk about when we've got a problem, something we're trying to work out. And there's still time for you to share your story. Who do you go to when you've got something to figure out, to hash out? Do you reach out to the people closest to you in your life, that spouse, parent, sibling, whatever, closest friend? Or sometimes do you need somebody with a little bit of distance, or are you someone who people come to? Maybe because of your line of work, you're that cab driver or bartender or hairstylist or barber. Let us know on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Here's a thing that I didn't know was a thing. There's a growing number of axe throwing venues around the country where you, yes, throw an axe. I just learned that Milwaukee already has one, and now an axe throwing bar is going to open up in the city. Producer Chris Molina is in here with me. Would you, Chris, go to a bar to drink, A, and throw some axes, B?
So let me say that I love the idea of bar games. I love playing shuffleboard. I love playing pool. I'd like to go home at the end of the night without a serious injury to myself. And, you know, when you can make an argument that darts may be a little dangerous, but at least in the bar, they're usually the plastic tip dart, and I don't think you could recreate that with the axe. So I think the answer is no to your questions.
Okay, but these are laid out, I guess, and supposedly, I mean, this is a national thing. There are championships and stuff, I guess, for axe throwing, and presumably they've got it lined up so you're throwing in a direction that's away from people. There's lanes, I guess.
Away from people, still really close to your own leg.
Okay, I hear that. Well, I guess there's a style you'd have to learn of axe throwing.
Yeah, and I don't know if it's overhand or if it's underhand, whatever way, you're getting close to some serious, organs, and I don't want anything to do with that.
Well, I want a lot of planning because I have spent time in bars with dart boards, but like they're laid out so that kind of if you want to get from one place to another in the bar, you kind of have to walk across that path. So it requires a lot of forbearance on everybody's part.
That's true. And is this the reason that you're wearing glasses right now?
Yeah, to know where the dart's hitting.
Oh, to avoid the
significant
eye injury.
Yeah. Could be. Chris, thanks a lot. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.